Afghan government officials and Taliban representatives attending a high-level peace talk in Tehran agree that war is not the solution to Afghanistan's issues. Several countries in the Asia-Pacific region report more coronavirus deaths and infections while struggling with a new wave of the virus. Japan says organizers of the Tokyo Olympics have agreed to hold the event without spectators under a COVID-19 state of emergency. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behruz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Parties to the intra-Afghan talks in Tehran have agreed on the need for an immediate halt to the war in Afghanistan, stressing that violence cannot resolve problems. In a joint statement following the talks, Afghan government and Taliban negotiators said that all efforts must focus on political solutions. They called for the continuation of dialogue. Meantime, the Iranian Foreign Minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, urged the warring sides to take the opportunity to end the war and prepare the ground for the development of the war-torn country. In an address, Zarif said that Iran is ready to facilitate future talks aimed at bringing lasting peace to Afghanistan. Violence has surged over the past weeks, with government forces and Taliban militants involved in fighting over control of territories. Tehran University lecturer Fadi Zadi says that the people of Afghanistan want peace, and as they're tired of decades of fighting and bloodshed.
Afghanistan has been suffering from war for the last 40 or 50 years. I think that's enough. I think people in Afghanistan are tired of these fights. They're tired of civil war. They want peace and security. And one reason Taliban is advancing is that some people at least believe that the Taliban can bring them peace and security. That's the opinion they have. And so I think it's a good time to reach a political settlement, given the fact that the foreign powers are leaving. The British government announced today that they have left Afghanistan, which is good news. So I think it's about time to get to that point.
The British Prime Minister says his country has withdrawn most of its troops from Afghanistan, ending its official role in nearly a two-decade military engagement there.
All British troops assigned to NATO's mission in Afghanistan are now returning home, and for obvious reasons I will not disclose the timetable of our departure, though I can tell the House that most of our personnel have already left. The
training camps... Speaking in the parliamentary session, Johnson added that the rest of British military personnel will return to the country soon. British forces were deployed to Afghanistan under Washington's so-called War on Terror following the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. A total of 457 British soldiers have lost their lives in Afghanistan. The departure of U.K. forces comes after U.S. President Joe Biden announced that all American forces will leave the country by the 11th of September. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. Iran, Russia, and Turkey have decided to continue cooperation to decisively defeat Daesh terrorists and other terror groups in Syria. Now, that announcement was made in a statement following the 16th round of peace talks on the Syria crisis in the Kazakh capital. The three also renewed a commitment to Syrian sovereignty, independence, unity, and territorial integrity. The talks started on Wednesday with diplomatic delegations coming together for the event. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Geir Pedersen, also attended negotiations along with a delegation from the Syrian government and its opposing parties. The focus of this round of talks was the situation on the ground in Syria, as well as confidence-building measures, including a prisoner swap. An anti-Iran terror group has clinched a deal with another top American lobbying firm. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has committed so many terrorist attacks on Iranian soil, but that doesn't appear to affect the West, as it's warmly accommodating the terrorist group.
In what may appear to be an effort to gain more popularity, the anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen Khalq, or MKO, has signed a deal with a Washington-based lobby group. The terror group had clinched a $40,000 agreement with the BGR lobbying group just ahead of the terror organization's annual conference on Saturday. BGR includes former senior-level Democrats and Republicans in the White House, Congress, and U.S. executive branch departments and agencies. U.S. media, citing documents filed with the Justice Department, say the American lobby firm will now help out with the annual conference, which has previously seen top U.S. officials attend the gathering. But getting a new lobbying group ahead of the conference raises questions if things are not going too well with the terror group. It also raises further questions about Washington's agenda and role behind their support for the MKO.
The Americans are looking to MKO to advance the cause of weakening Iranian national security, because anyone who has an ounce of sense, anyone who has an ounce of enlightenment about the true nature of MKO realizes that MKO is a violent, bloodthirsty terrorist organization. So by the Americans portraying MKO as a benign, peace-loving, freedom-loving organization, will then lead on to MKO being projected by the Americans as an organization which is fighting for freedom.
Under the administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump, the MKO enjoyed warm support from the White House, who imposed the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. With the Biden administration coming in, things have slightly changed. Biden has been sending a delegation to Vienna, which is engaged indirectly in talks with Iran with a view to revive the Iran nuclear deal. There is a new president-elect in Iran as well, so the MKO may need to go back to the drawing board on how to approach their conference this year.
Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, the MEK has performed numerous terrorist attacks against Iranian civilians and government officials alike. Out of nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in those attacks over the past four decades, 12,000 have fallen victim to the MKO. For a long time, the MKO, or MEK, was considered to be a terrorist organization by the U.S. and EU. So the question is why some Western countries are now given a special treatment in propagating it as an Iranian opposition group.
The U.S. State Department added the MKO to its list of foreign terrorist organizations in 1997 for the group's involvement in the killing of Americans in Iran in the 1970s and an attack on U.S. soil in 1992. The group has also been described as a bizarre, shadowy, brainwashing cult. According to a 2007 State Department report, MKO members are also required to take a vow of eternal divorce and participate in weekly ideological cleansing sessions. Washington designated it as a terror outfit for 15 years, until a wide-scale campaign by U.S. officials and lobbying groups backed by millions of dollars resulted in a successful delisting in 2012. Former attendees at the MKO events have admitted to receiving tens of thousands of dollars from the terrorists in speaking engagement fees. Most notably, at their now annual lavish conference in the French capital, Paris. One participant at this conference and longtime supporter of the group is former U.S. National Security Advisor and top Iran hawk John Bolton, who regularly speaks at MKO events. He once infamously declared that before 2019, they will be celebrating with him in the Iranian capital, Tehran itself, something that did not exactly materialize as planned, as noted by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Other prominent supporters are ex-US President Donald Trump's personal lawyer and former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, another long-term supporter who acknowledged being on the MKO's payroll, former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and former Saudi Arabian spy chief Prince Turki Al-Faisal. The terror group was located in Iraq under the Saddam Hussein era and committed numerous atrocities against Iranians using Iraqi soil until Saddam himself was toppled. That's when America helped them set up a base in Albania and the freedom to travel between Europe and America, where they are said to have aggressively tried to purchase the services of former and current Western government employees. However, members in the highly fortified camp in Albania are prevented from leaving, meaning some parents have not seen their children in decades. Big double standards here by the United States. The terrorists they don't like are met with bombs. Terrorists they do like, who have even killed American civilians, are supported and met with hospitality. Tehran has warned Washington against being misled by the group's anti-Iran propaganda campaign, saying Washington has suffered every time it trusted the MKO. Yet, since 2012, Western officials and allied media outlets have tried their best to propagandize the terrorists as an Iranian opposition group.
Now moving on, several countries in the Asia-Pacific region have reported more coronavirus deaths than infections while struggling with a new wave, largely driven by the Delta variant. Thailand has recorded a new daily record of 75 deaths and 7,000 more cases. The figure pushes the country's overall death toll to 2,400 and a caseload to 300,000. South Korea logged its highest ever one-day rise of 1,300 infections. Officials consider imposing a semi-lockdown in capital Seoul, that's the epicenter of the new wave. India reported some 46,000 new infections, pushing the tally to more than 30,000. The death toll stands at 405,000. Meanwhile, Australia is already locked down. State of New South Wales reported 38 cases on Thursday, its biggest daily rise in 2021. The state's total infections are now nearing 400. Japan's Olympics minister has announced that the upcoming games in Tokyo will be organized without spectators due to a coronavirus state of emergency there. The announcement followed talks between government officials, organizers, and members of the Olympic Committee. Organizers said that allowing spectators at venues outside the capital will be decided based on the local situation. Now, this is seen as a sharp U-turn from a statement just weeks ago when organizers said that they intended to hold Olympic Games with limited audience. Earlier today, Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga officially declared a state of COVID emergency in Tokyo just a fortnight before the city is going to kickstart the Summer Olympics.
We must strengthen the countermeasures to prevent the infections from spreading to the rest of the country again. Given the situation, we will issue a state of emergency for Tokyo and extend it in Okinawa until August 22.
Suga said that the impact of COVID-19 variants need to be taken into consideration while Tokyo is hosting the events. The state of emergency was first issued in January. Still, Japan's vaccination rollout is slow. Just 15% of the population has been fully inoculated. Japan has recorded more than 800,000 cases and 15,000 deaths. The games were postponed in March last year due to the pandemic. Sudan has condemned Ethiopia for starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River, considering it a clear violation of international law.
Sudan condemns Ethiopia's start of second phase of filling the controversial Nile Dam, warning the move violates existing agreements and threatens security in the region. The warning came after Sudan's Minister of Irrigation and Water Resources received a letter from Ethiopian counterpart informing him of the start of the second filling of the dam during the current rainy season. Despite drums of war appear, the government of Sudan ruled out any military solution to resettle the situation.
I think the military option, to my understanding, is out of question. It's not going to happen, especially for Sudan, because the battle will be in Sudan. And maybe Ethiopia will retaliate if they attack Gerd. Maybe they are going to retaliate in Osir Dam or anywhere else. And the areas there will be affected. So, and this is not the solution.
Experts insist that no other option rather than negotiation within the international law is available for Sudan.
The National Court of Justice, which is an organ of the United Nations, according to its rules, No country can take another country to that court unless the country has already agreed to go before the International Court of Justice, and definitely Syria would not agree to that. So there is no international legal channel available to the government of Sudan.
Last month, Sudan and Egypt had sent a letter asking the UN Security Council to take up the issue. Talks mediated by the African Union most recently in the Democratic Republic of Congo have repeatedly stalled. According to Sudanese authorities, the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam is being built about 15 kilometers from border with Sudan on the Blue Nile, the source of most of the Nile's water, yet it affects life of 20 million people in this area.
Isaac Tsiperce, with starting the next phase of filling the controversial mega dam on the Nile River by Ethiopia, the ball is now on the court of Sudan and Egypt. But as things stand, the two countries are still waiting for an action by the UN. Mohammed Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Legislators claim that EU nations are more interested in deporting refugees than affording them the protection that they are entitled to under international law. Hundreds of desperate asylum seekers continue to die at sea attempting to reach the EU. Jerome Hughes has more.
Latest figures from the International Organization for Migration show so far this year 898 refugees have died in the Mediterranean Sea while trying to reach EU soil. That's three times more compared to the same period last year. The subject has, yet again, just been debated in the European Parliament.
Europe is no longer in a migration crisis.
That remark by EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson has incensed many lawmakers. Legislators and rights groups highlight reports that EU countries such as Greece and Italy are aggressively pushing refugee vessels away from their shores. Other EU nations like Austria and Hungary have closed their borders to these desperate people. A €6.3 billion fund has been agreed by the European Parliament to help member states manage the refugee issue. The EU is continuing its policy of sending billions of euro to Turkey and Libya so that authorities there prevent the flow of refugees to the 27-nation bloc. Campaigners say at no point since the crisis started in 2015 has the EU taken responsibility. They say the main source of the problem relates to attempts by Western powers to destroy and take over Syria. Now EU leaders are being urged to show some compassion and solidarity. However, rights groups say that is wishful thinking. Anti-refugee politicians such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban have the power to veto any proposals that are presented here. Jerome Hughes at the European Council, Brussels.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Limelight. 14 years of brutal mass confinement, chronic malnutrition, trauma, psychological problems, and thousands of people maimed by weapons from land, sea, and air. These go on deepening Gaza's widespread depression and despair. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Muhammad Jihad Ismail, a Gaza resident and writer. This article is published under the heading, Palestinian Families Face Another Summer of Needless Suffering in Gaza. Here's more on the story. Muhammad Jihad Ismail, Gaza resident, and the writer of the article says, "My family and I, my wife, our younger son, our elders, and the twin baby girls who will be born to us soon, ask the world to hear the conditions of our lives here in Deir al-Balah, after 14 years captivity in the world's largest toxic prison camp, and since the May waves of Israeli regime tank shells, artillery shells, rockets, and bombs have stopped exploding in our midst. In some ways, this calm is harder than open war. Right now, war continues in dispossessions of Palestinian residents from the neighborhoods of East Al-Quds. Here, most of the Gaza Strip's assets, infrastructure, and services are in catastrophic ruins. So there is almost no water feed for drinking, washing, or just cooling off in this season's volcanic record heat, no water that will not rot our teeth and ruin our stomachs, almost no water for the vegetable gardens that keep us barely alive. With luck, we have 8 hours of daily electricity even to pump it into household holding tanks. As May began Gaza's crucial fishing season, the Zionist regime banned boats altogether from the sea. Now that boats can venture at most 6 miles out or take fire from gunboats, their catches are as insufficient as the mere 200 daily trucks of other food allowed into the strip by the Israeli regime. 200 trucks divided by 2.5 million people, equivalent to 12,500 people supposedly fed by a single truck. Desperate for protein and nourishment, Gaza residents are forced to buy frozen fish from the trucks. This is often spoiled when it reaches Gazans. And what can a captive do? Complain? To whom? With any hope of a hearing? They hang on with raw courage and creativity. Palestinian and Egyptian bulldozers labor in the heat, clearing mountains of rubble from streets and crowded neighborhoods, filling in craters from bombs aimed to block crucial roads to hospitals. last week on Raw, professionals distributed food parcels, but somehow not including powdered milk, which might have replaced tanker trucks of milk so needed by young ones, but now forbidden them with no explanation by the Zionist regime. For all this, restrictions on trade and traffic in and out of Gaza are more severe than ever. Marketplace stalls are missing many important items, while other goods pile up unsold because people lack money to buy them. Workers and farmers lose the pittances they could earn, for their employers can scarcely get a hold of raw materials or export their products. Years of brutal mass confinement, chronic malnutrition, trauma, psychological problems, and thousands of people maimed by weapons from land, sea, and air. These go on deepening Gaza's widespread depression and despair. Muhammad Jihad Ismail says, "Yet, in the face of life itself grinding to a halt, we dream and work for a new, full, and fair elections. This week, we will celebrate the birth of our two daughters. And in both ways, we Palestinians will go on struggling for equality among our neighbors in accord with international law. In the face of so much needless human suffering, we ask the good people all over the world to reach out into action for true justice."
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm Yusuf Jalali, and this is Face to Face. Saudi Arabia and a number of its regional allies, including the United Arab Emirates, waged a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. The onslaught is aimed at reinstating the ousted pro-Riyadh Yemeni president Abdurrabbuh Mansour Hadi back to power. Estimates show that the war has so far claimed the lives of more than 100,000 Yemeni people. To get a deeper insight, I'm sitting face to face with the Yemeni ambassador to Iran, Ibrahim Mohammed Al-Dainami. Welcome to the show. Well, what is Saudi Arabia looking for in Yemen?
In the name of God, the Almighty, most merciful, thank you for having me in our embassy in Tehran, and we thank you for being with us. Concerning what does Saudi Arabia want from Yemen, as all know, Saudi Arabia wants Yemen to be divided, they want to be weak. This is, unfortunately, the Saudi kingdom is a bad neighbor. We're talking about more than 100 years of Yemeni-Saudi conflict. For the last 100 years, they've been trying to interfere in our internal affairs. And in the history, recently, this has to do unfortunately, with very much suffering, has enforced too much suffering on the Yemeni people. The Saudis and who stand with it and this aggression against Yemen, it's only to have hegemony and superiority over Yemen and everything that they've done in the last few years. What we have done in our resistance against this aggression is to have sovereignty for Yemen, and the Saudis are trying very strongly to try to have control over Yemen and to and weaken its dignity and its sovereignty. We are also, they want to decide who becomes the president of Yemen and who is not the president of Yemen. Even the mayors and the governors and so on, they want to decide. They have always been decisions made by the Saudis, and even in the institutions which were supported by Saudi Arabia. We can see how weak they are. After this aggression specifically, we saw that there were dreams that they wanted to enforce, but they saw that the Yemeni people were very
the
much resilient
drive that
and they were very much steadfast in the face of all
the war against Yemen,
this aggression.
Was to return Abdul Rabbuh Mansur Hadi back to power. What is so special about Mansur Hadi?
Abdul Rabbuh Mansur Hadi is the one whose campaign has ended and his term has ended, and he went as a president. He went into elections where there was only one candidate, that was Abdul Mansur Hadi, through this so-called initiative of the Persian Gulf initiative, and he is the main manifestation of everything that we are talking about, of the control against of Yemen, which was enforced upon them, what they wanted in Sana'a, this Yemeni government. And for example, 2014, when there was an uprising for the people, the Saudis wanted to bring back their hegemony and their support, superiority over Yemen, their control over Yemen through this issue. He was the one who was in the face of this aggression, and he was taken as a pretext in order to launch this aggression. And it was mainly, and he said he had nothing to do with this aggression. He never heard about the fact that there would be an aggression in 2015, and he would not allow this aggression, and that he said that through media. What he considered this as another catastrophe for the Yemeni people. They wanted to continue to collaborate with this president.
Has been a major counterforce in Yemen that has stood against the Saudi aggression against your country. Initially, the movement fought with very limited arms arsenal, but now it has sophisticated weapons, including drones and missiles, and is really inflicting heavy losses against Saudi Arabia. I'm curious to know how this progress has been made there.
As you know, this huge aggression that was committed against Yemen, which has used all capabilities against Yemen, and the Yemeni people are a very dignified people, and they will not surrender to this aggression, and they will face and confront this aggression. And thank God we have the strength and the capabilities of the Yemeni army and the popular forces of Yemen. They were ready to prepare and ready themselves and arm themselves, and this is well known. The Yemeni army already had arms, this is well known, and was sold in the markets. And there is a means for us to get these arms, and the Yemeni army was one of the biggest armies that was there in the Cold War, and even one part of Yemen was in the socialist side, and they were also linked, another side was linked to the Western campaign, and there was two different schools of thought, the Western and the Eastern, and the popular forces, what they did in the change of this ideology of the army of Yemen and the military forces of Yemen were able to defeat the U.S. Projects in Yemen. Of course, this is when we need something we need to create and built. And this is what happened when they saw that this aggression was launched upon them. They had many expertise that were used, and thank God now we even create unmanned airplanes. And this is something that we see that was witnessed by the enemy before the friend, that the military army was able to face an international war against it and show that the many armies that were very strong and superior were this Yemeni army with the people of Yemen, and the fighters were able to face this issue here. We're on the seventh year of this aggression, and the Yemeni people with God's faith, and thank God we were able to face this aggression, of course, with all the enemies that we have arms from Russia and China also as well, and the Yemeni people. The Yemeni army also had armaments as well.
Where does Iran stand in the Yemeni-Saudi conflict, and what is the relationship between Iran and Ansarullah movement in Yemen?
The relationship between the with the Islamic Republic of Iran and Ansarullah in Yemen, it's not just with Ansarullah in Yemen. This is a very strong relationship and ties between the government of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the government of Yemen. This is a new revolutionary thought that was there, that was present with Yemen, and there were also different envoys, diplomatic envoys to both countries, and Iran was also there to serve and help the Yemeni people. The Islamic Republic of Iran is the only and main country that stood with the Yemeni people and spoke against the aggression and called on lifting the sanctions against the people of Yemen and was insisting on speaking for the Yemeni people. The media, of course, and also in the Islamic Republic of Iran, also spoke towards the international public opinion about this aggression and the need to lift this this choking sanctions against the Yemeni people. The support also for the military forces in Lebanon, also in Yemen, and support and diplomatic support for Yemen was also very evident, as many countries stood silent in this aggression, and they spoke about how the fact neighbors should be good neighbors with each other, and that anyone who is an aggressor launches an aggression against the Yemeni people is with the U.S. and with its hegemony, and those who stand with
since
Yemen
February,
with
the Yemeni
Islam
forces
and with
have
the
been
nation.
Trying to liberate Ma'rib, the last northern stronghold of the Saudi-backed militants and an oil-rich region there. How close are you to a full liberation there?
In reality, everyone should know, the viewers should understand, the dear viewers should know that the Ma'rib, that area, was also a launching ground for the enemy and the aggressions. And it had transformed into a post, a military post for the aggressive forces, for the Saudis and the Emirates and the Sudanese, and even the American experts that were there working to lead and monitor this aggression. Of course, we have called on the United Nations to keep Ma'rib aside in order to keep the people of Yemen safe. This is the main district in Yemen, which has very rich in resources, because Ma'rib also gives electricity to other sectors and districts in Yemen. But they transformed this into a conflict, and the United Nations has called on marginalizing this area, but the enemy continued to launch its campaign, a military campaign against Sana'a and other areas. The Yemeni people had to launch a retaliation, an offensive against the posts in that area in order to liberate Baida and Jouf, and they have also liberated so many areas of certain small areas of municipalities in Ma'rib. You have around four districts or areas that were liberated within Maghreb. This was the plan from the beginning, and they were liberated as planned. And now we want to liberate all of Maghreb in order to bring it back to the nation, to its country, and to also liberate it from Daesh and Al-Qaeda. And we need, and of course, the military forces and the popular forces fight side by side, the aggressive forces, and they know where the Al-Qaeda is, where Daesh is, and anyone who fights with Saida, with Saudi Arabia, and the mercenaries
talks,
will be fought
the
in
the Yemeni Arab. Peace talks, of course, have been ongoing since 2018. What are the major sticking points, and have there been any headways so far?
In reality, the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations have more than one round of talks. We had two times in Geneva, and we also had two different talks in Kuwait and in Oman. We also have so many, we have other talks in Sweden to talk about several files related to humanitarian issues and to talk about the issue of certain districts inside Yemen. But United Nations unfortunately moved aside from what is right when they did not translate issues in the right way. They considered the conflict a Yemeni-Yemeni conflict, but they should have said from the beginning that it is an aggression against Yemen. It's a foreign aggression against Yemen. In reality, we believe that the negotiations that are being mediated by the United Nations will only be a failure. That will be the final attempt of these talks, and this thus they are able to describe this aggression. This requires courage from the United Nations to speak about this aggression in the right way and not to say that they need to stop this aggression against the people and to say that this is an aggression from the Saudi Arabia and the Americans, and they need to lift the blockade against Yemen, and they need to withdraw all foreign forces, the Saudi, the Emirates, and others, and leave the Yemenis on their own in order to have their talks inside Yemen, as they also have, as this Yemen has been an aggression from the Saudis, is an internal interference. These talks, we've tried to say these words to the United Nations. We have not reached any solution in this. We've not reached anything. So therefore, unfortunately, the United Nations, they were not dealing with the issue
the
in a logical
now,
way.
And has really turned into a war of attrition and is costing Riyadh huge money and casualties. Does this mean that Riyadh has failed to achieve its goals in Yemen?
What is truth is that our main aims is to stop this aggression. There are the main aims for the aggression, and there are even hidden aims. All the aims that they have set in order to they want to achieve in Yemen have failed very strongly, and specifically, there is no more a government for the president, Abdel Hadi Mansour, and they will not able to create any infliction upon the Yemeni forces, and they wanted to break the will of the Yemeni people. But if we were talking about killing the Yemenis, about tens of thousands, or destroying the infrastructure of Yemen, they succeeded in that. There are also tens of thousands of wounded. Tens of thousands of homes were destroyed, and there were also losses on the central bank. There are also many people who are in famine, and there's so much hunger and famine in the country. This is what Saudi Arabia succeeded in very strongly. But anything else, they failed, a very heavy loss. They only wanted to enforce their hegemony, their political hegemony on the Yemeni people. They could not enforce this hegemony. They could not change the government in Yemen. They could not even try to incite the people and stop the people from facing the Zionist project. So the war against Yemen was the ladder that Mohammed bin Salman wanted in order to reach rule in Saudi Arabia. The objectives of Saudi Arabia are the result of its lack of reality and its illegitimate endeavor. And they need to stop this aggression and lift the sanctions in order to give the Yemeni people their will. Then we need to stop also any interference in internal issues.
The Saudi-led coalition on the part of Riyadh and on the part of Yemen, Ansarullah movement. So these are on the outside, the warring sides. But the United States has been fanning the flames of the conflict. We do know that Washington has made a bundle out of selling arms to Riyadh during the conflict. Is there all about economic gains, or is there a political dimension to it?
The United States and its role on the aggression against Yemen, we said from the first day, is a Saudi-U.S. aggression. This began in the capital of the United States in Washington at the time of President Obama, and at that time with Adel al-Jubayr, when then he was the foreign, he was ambassador to America. And from the first day of the aggression, the Saudi aggression against Yemen, they had support, logistics support, and intelligence support, and they had a big role to play in the support of the sanctions against Yemen, whether from the sea or the air or the land, and any sort of vetoes that were enforced whether in United Nations Security Council. Therefore, the role of the United States is the biggest and the aim, the most prominent role.
The Obama administration. It continued throughout the Trump administration, and now Joe Biden has promised, of course, to stop the U.S. aid to Riyadh in the war against Yemen. Has anything changed so far?
Actually, the American president, Joe Biden, the new president, has also taken this file, the Yemen file, and the aggression as an election card, something that he can use to try to change. He said he wanted a direct ending of the war on Yemen. He wanted to launch political talks. But after he won the elections, he lied to his electors, and he was still continue to support the sanctions and the blockade, and he did not fulfill his promise in stopping this aggression. Of course, we do not rely on the promises of the U.S. because it was the Democrats. It was the time of the Democrats that launched this war against Yemen. So Joe Biden's promises will not be understood, and even the so-called Gulf Initiative, or the American Initiative, they will not enforce any sort of hegemony on Yemen. That was also even before that was signed by Joe Biden himself. But when they also failed ethically, the U.S. failed ethically, even through his electoral campaign, that the United States will not fulfill the promise because it is the main partner in this aggression. They only wanted to try to mediate certain talks and to assist those who are Saudi Arabia and those who are launching this war against Yemen. And even there's for example, the islands in Jayoun and Supatra, they are proof that
the
presence of the Americans there, and there shows that they are the ones.
Saudi Arabia has imposed sea and air blockade against Yemen that has kept the flow of food, medicine, and even humanitarian aid from reaching the desperate Yemeni people. I'm wondering how the Yemeni people can get their hands on the humanitarian supplies.
Also, dear brother, we cannot hide the fact that the sanctions is the other face of this aggression. There's one form of the aggression, which is the shelling and the bombing, but there is another form of this aggression, which is the sanctions, which has stopped the Yemeni and the medication and food from coming into Yemen and to the Yemenis. And here we're talking about thousands of people who are ill and need hospitalization. We're talking about people with chronic diseases. People who went to the Sana'a airport, we're not talking about one or two, we're talking about tens of thousands of wounded who could not leave the country in order to receive medicine and hospitalization outside the country. This has weakened the Yemeni people. This has shown the ugly face of the Americans and the Saudis who have enforced the sanctions against the Yemeni people. And people call on the international community to bring and allow the money to come in and the medicine and assistance to come into Yemen. Yemenis do not need assistance, but what they need is a lifting of these and sanctions, and we can bring in our own assistance, our own support. We do not want to call for assistance from any side, but what the international community needs to do is its duty to open the airports, to open the ports, and lift these sanctions. We do not need to call for assistance from them, but there's a catastrophe. There's a humanitarian catastrophe. And because it's closed and this needs to stop, and allow the Yemeni people who also need this humanitarian, support in this, what we've seen of also that the humanitarian crisis, the United States,
the United Nations itself has said this is the biggest
humanitarian crisis in the world.
People in Yemen are in dire need of humanitarian aid, including 10 million suffering from extreme levels of hunger. Tell us more about the humanitarian side effects of the Saudi-led coalition's aggression against your country and how grave the situation is for Yemen.
The humanitarian situation in Yemen is very grave. We're talking about a humanitarian catastrophe which has resulted from this aggression. We cannot come and have numbers specifically now because these are adding up on a daily basis. We see that on the first day there was a certain number. On the second day we saw that the number was double in the casualties and so on. The people who had, for example, main parts and so on, and wounded. This is a suffering of more than $10 billion of losses on the Yemeni people, but this will not stop the Yemeni people from confronting this aggression, stopping this aggression in order to retrieve the political will and political determination, freedom for our people. And the people, the free people of the world, need to stand with the injustice against the Yemeni people, who stand against this injustice against the Yemeni people. This is our campaign, and this is our national duty, and we see that we are with also the front of the resistance and Al-Quds and the resistance against Zionists.
All right, that's it for this edition of Face to Face. I'm Yusuf Jalali. See you next time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en, And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.